Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients a solution for failed root canal-treated teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. It's Williams v. Williams in the U.S. Open Finals today. No surprise there, since Serena and Venus are ranked number 1 and 2 in the world. On the men's side of the tournament, there are some surprises. Pete Sampras, written off numerous times as ancient, survives, as does fellow old guy Andre Agassi. Joining me now to discuss the Open and provide infallible predictions is that happily haberdashered follower of the fuzzy ball, Bud Collins. Hey, Bud.
Well, Bill, my predictions, let me give you the first one. It was Murat Safin, the headless horseman. I thought, sure, he would go farther than the second round.
Long gone and hard to find.
But he didn't. Now I still have one alive. I picked Venus at the start of the tournament, and when Safin disappeared, I figured I got another chance, so I picked Andre Agassi.
I'm not sure how to rank the surprises of this tournament, but I think I know which one Andy Roddick would place first. I don't imagine he expected to lose to Pete Sampras, and especially in straight sets.
Not like that. Not like that at all. Sampras covered him like the smog covers Los Angeles. Poor Andy. He didn't know which way to turn. Whatever he tried didn't work, and Pete was playing superlatively. Now, Andy had a sore left foot, I guess, but I'm sure it got sorer as each game went by.
On the other side of the draw, Andre Agassi today faces the number one player in the world, Leighton Hewitt. How do you like the possibility of a Sampras-Agassi final?
Well, that would be wonderful, and I think I'm not speaking for CBS alone, but I think there's a chance. Sampras going against Cheng Schalken, a very good Dutch player who gave Hewitt his toughest match at Wimbledon. 5 sets. He was up a break in the fifth. So Pete is not going to glide, but I think he will win. Now, Andre is going to have to put in a long afternoon. I wouldn't be surprised if it's 5 sets against Hewitt. Hewitt has beaten him before, but not in such an extended contest. And I think Andre's going to do it, but it's going to be very, very difficult.
Well, who wins if those two guys get to play each other?
I think Agassi.
I gather that one of the sillier controversies at this Open involved the sleeveless shirt which Tommy Haas was told he could not wear. A little reverse discrimination there, considering how the female players have been dressing?
Well, it was pretty absurd. That was the night that Serena Williams was, well, somewhat covered by her costume, called the cat suit, and that's okay. I mean, if I'm the referee, Brian Early, I'd look that over and say, yes, yes, let's see more of you. But then poor Tommy Haas puts on this jersey that really is like a basketball singlet, and referee Early says, son, that's an evil thing. You're going to show us your biceps, aren't you? So that was ruled off.
Now, on the women's side, the bangers you nicknamed the Sisters Sledge sometime back prevailed yesterday. We'll handicap their latest confrontation in just a moment. But first, Bud, I read this week that somewhere around 1.4 million people in this country are pursued at one point or another by stalkers. One of them has been stalking Serena Williams, and that guy was caught at the Open. He was jailed, and it was great that he was arrested. But how did he get into the tournament?
Albrecht Strohmeier. Well, I suppose he may have bought a ticket even. You can do that. It's so amusing, perhaps not amusing to some people, but the security here is overbearing, overpowering, but I guess we have to understand that it's New York where the tragedy occurred. But when I say overbearing and overpowering, the press, we gentlemen of the press, practically had to sign our lives away to get credentials. Meanwhile, spectators can walk in they don't have to be too clever to hide anything, and this guy, I think, bought a ticket and walked in, even though he may or may not be a dangerous character. Actually, I don't think anybody's too smart to stalk Serena. I think she can take care of herself.
Well, she took care of matters on the court yesterday, no question about that. The remarkable thing about the two Williams sisters seemed to me that each of them reached a point in her match where she simply decided, okay, enough of this, and then ripped off 8 straight points, and that was that.
That's it. That's the way they do it. Venus, in winning last year, did the same thing. You go back to the Wimbledon final of 2001. She's playing Justine Henin of Belgium. One set all. Henin is getting very encouraged. Venus says, enough, and bagels her, just like that. Last year, Jennifer Capriati's ahead in the semifinals, 4-2. And Venus looked at the scoreboard, apparently said, oh, for goodness sakes, I'm behind, and won practically all the rest of the games. And that's what happened against Emily Maresmo yesterday. There is Venus down, love 40. Maresmo is within 1 point of tying the third set, 5-all, and Venus suddenly said, well, I think I better start serving. Bang, 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 an ace, three service winners, and it's all over.
So who do you like in today's edition of Williams v. Williams?
I'm picking Venus. I've picked her from the start, and everybody else, I think, certainly Serena is the favorite, but I think Venus is getting just a little tired of getting pushed around by little sister, three straight, even though they are very, very close. And when it's all over, as Serena said, when her match finished, she said, we'll fight each other, but when it's over, we're friendly and close again.
Collins of the Globe joining us to talk about tennis. Bud, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. Who are your picks?
Well, at least I don't have to tell you who has already been eliminated, but I want to see Serena win. I like the way she plays.
Okay, I'll tell her that. That'll certainly inspirit her.
Sister Serena. Sister Serena. There ain't nobody meaner than Sister Serena.
Yesterday, the U.S. Senate approved a Homeland Security bill, which includes language requiring a minimum of 28 hours of self-defense training for flight attendants. Since the September 11th attacks, a small number of flight attendants and American Air travelers have already learned self-defense strategies specifically designed for use in the event of a hijacking. The J.K. Lee Taekwondo Black Belt Academy in Milwaukee is one martial arts school offering a course in air safety. Wisconsin Public Radio's Chuck Kornbach has this report.
The federal government and the airline industry have spent millions of dollars in an attempt to increase airline safety since last September's attacks. But some flyers still don't feel all that comfortable. Javier Avero takes a lot of business flights, including to Central and South America.
It's not only terrorism. I think it's more vandalism and terrorism. And depending on, you know, different situations, different kind of people, a person could be sitting next to you, and it could look like a regular person, but it's not a regular person. You never know.
Avero is a muscular 25-year-old who says he knows how to fight. But he says he's interested in learning more about self-defense for travelers. So Avero and about a dozen others, ranging in age from their 20s to their 50s, have spent about $100 apiece to come to AirSafe. AirSafe is a four-hour traveler safety program in Milwaukee that combines a safety lecture with physical training techniques borrowed from Taekwondo, Karate, and Kung Fu. Instructor Gary Klugowitz tells the group the best thing to do is stay out of altercations. But he says to do that, travelers have to remain alert.
If you're not watching, you're never going to see it coming. And I will tell you, the great equalizer in life is the baseball bat from the blind side. Doesn't matter how much of martial arts you learn, we get whacked upside the head, you don't see it coming, you're done.
But Klugowitz says travelers using mass transit, and even pedestrians, can't always avoid danger or get out of it quickly. So AirSafe instruction includes self-defense. Klugowitz says when you need to fight back, look around for items that usually aren't viewed as weapons. As an example, he picks up and waves an airplane seat cushion.
And if someone is trying to slash at me, I'm going to run them into something hard. But it's a tool to use.
Klugowitz also recommends using personal items for self-defense. AirSafe student and flight attendant Vinay Liska likes the idea of using a key, her wedding ring, or a pen.
On my uniform, I clip my pen in the same very same spot he had his, right there. Easy access to whip it out. Maybe people have always known that, but I guess I wasn't aware that the first weapon isn't always in the next overhead bin or under a seat. It's right on my uniform.
AirSafe training warns that when weapons are not within reach, you may need to get physical. Gary Klugowitz velcros on a so-called red man suit, red-colored head-to-toe padding often used in martial arts training. He imitates a would-be attacker and one by one instructs his students to kick, elbow, or knee him out of the way.
Ready? Go! No, no, no. You pushed away too far. Come on! Here we go.
Students in AirSafe also learn how to team up and bring attackers to the ground. AirSafe's owners talk of expanding the class to other cities as airlines have hired martial arts schools to train flight crews in other airline hubs. Some are concerned that travelers are being trained to be paranoid, but AirSafe president and creator Chan Lee disagrees.
We're also advocating that the passengers and travelers that are out on an airplane or anywhere else are taking direction from the flight attendants. The flight attendants effectively becomes the quarterback of the whole situation. She'll direct what needs to be done, or if the situation is not correct, now obviously for bombs or something like that, then it's something that, you know, AirSafe training is not equipped to train for.
AirSafe student Brett Schwant is also sensitive to the issue of vigilantism. But he says even with the training, he'll be careful.
There's that really fine line where it looks like you're either restraining the person or you're beating the person. And you have to make sure that what you're doing is restraining the person. And if the subject comes up, you have to be able to explain to people what you're doing and the legalities of it.
Schwant says he was once robbed at gunpoint and was nervous and jumpy for about a year. 1 year after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, there's a segment of U.S. air travelers who feel the same way. But AirSafe students say they feel more secure after taking the course. For Only a Game, I'm Chuck Kornbach in Milwaukee.
Let me go! Let me go!
It's 18 minutes past the hour. If Chelly Pingree fails in her bid to win a seat in the U.S. Senate, it won't be for lack of a sense of humor. She's willing to make an utter or utter fool of herself. Pingree credited her political pull with her victory in a cow milking contest at the Windsor State Fair in Maine on Labor Day. She milked 2 quarts into a bucket in 3 minutes. Her Republican opponent was not able to attend the competition, but Pingree did outmilk a dozen candidates running for lesser offices. The aspiring senator won a blanket decorated with scenes from Augusta as well as a blue ribbon.
I know my mama's milk cow. I can tell the way she lows. Now if you've seen my milk cow, ooh, won't you drive her on home? Now I ain't had no milking butter. Since my cow's been gone.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Oakland's win streak comes to an end thanks to the Twins. To read more, log on to our website, WBUR.org, and click on News. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Direct Tire and Auto Service, whose 100 employees in Watertown, Norwood, Peabody, and Natick appreciate the support of WBUR listeners. They'll fix it so it breaks. Online at directtire.com. And by Tufts Health Plan, offering a wide range of health plan designs to meet the needs of employers and their employees. Details at TuftsHealthPlan.com. Sunny and warm today, highs in the 80s, tonight's lows in the 60s. Hazy sunshine tomorrow will be breezy, hot, humid, highs near 90 degrees. Monday could see near record-breaking high in the 90s. It's 720, 64 degrees in Boston.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, beach volleyball's ebbing popularity. But first, the lummoxes of the autumnal equinox are in prime condition, at least temporarily, to entertain the nation. Rodeo? No, the NFL. Here now to preview the season is Paul Attner of the Sporting News. Paul, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hey, Bill, how are you?
I'm well, thank you. And I think the logical place to start is by asking not if the New England Patriots will repeat as Super Bowl champions, but who'll be the runner-up. Maybe you detect a bit of post-championship arrogance there.
I thought you were going to ask me rodeo questions there for a minute. I'm glad we're concentrating on football.
Well, I hate to tell you that I'm going to continue my trend from last year and feel that the Patriots are not a Super Bowl team. And I was wrong last year, but I'm determined to be right this year. So I think that the Rams are the best team in football, and barring an injury to their quarterback Kurt Warner, they should be win the Super Bowl this year that they did not win last year, and they legitimately lost that game because the Patriots were the better team that day.
You climb on a very crowded bandwagon when you say that. Has any defending champion since Leon Spinks ever been so lightly regarded?
No, it is remarkable, and you're going to ask me why, and it's going to be a long answer, I'm afraid. But the Patriots, I don't think, have been picked by anybody. Not that we know really, you know, what we're doing here, but they won last year on a combination of great team chemistry, some fortunate breaks, and outstanding play by a quarterback, and great coaching, and all that. It took all that to get them to the Super Bowl and to win it. And usually, the second time around, all that doesn't combine. There's something in that formula that goes wrong. That's what history has told us. And I think in this case, because we're not enamored with the Patriots' actual personnel ability, that we just don't think they're going to be good enough to do it again.
Parity, of course, also has something to do with this.
Yeah, and parity is a wonderful thing. I'm a parity lover. I think that, you know, there's been three different Super Bowl champions the last 3 years. There's going to be another one this year, I think. I just don't see, again, the Patriots winning. And I think parity has created the fact that, you know, 24, 25 teams right now think they can legitimately win the Super Bowl. And they probably could. I mean, if the Patriots can do it, I mean, anybody can. And that's not a negative. That's a positive that, you know, the team that wasn't that good the year before can all of a sudden win a Super Bowl. I think it makes this league so competitive, unlike baseball, that it's the reason the NFL is so popular right now.
When people ask you who will win the Super Bowl 5 months in advance, do you ever find yourself wishing you covered the NBA?
No, as long as people don't remember who I pick, but you always remember. That's the problem. You know, I got to get you to forget who I pick. But
no, we're just figuring if it was the NBA, it's easy. You just say, yeah, the Lakers. Next question.
Oh, the Yankees, right? I mean, that's the beauty of the NFL. I mean, you don't know who is going to win, and you know, we're all speculating. And the NFL is just one injury away to a key player from all these predictions being 100% wrong. And that's how close everything is, but it also makes for all this fan entertainment and excitement and interest in the league.
Paul, you've already mentioned the Rams. What are the other three or four or five teams that have that shot?
Oh, I think in the NFC, the Packers certainly have helped themselves in the offseason. I think they are legitimate contenders. I think Tampa has a new coach in John Gruden, and that's just what they needed to be a legitimate contender. Philadelphia almost beat the Rams last year in the playoffs, and I think that they're certainly good enough to get to the Super Bowl. In the AFC, Oakland probably is still convinced they should have won that game against the Patriots, and you know, and I think they could be back again that close again. I think the Colts, to me, had a bad year last year, but they're the Patriots in my eyes of this year. I think the Colts, new coach Tony Dungy, I think they could be in the certainly in the Super Bowl this year with some better coaching that they're going to receive from him.
All right, here's a team with a new coach, a new stadium, and a new attitude. Is it the Cincinnati Bengals year?
Never will ever be the Cincinnati Bengals year. It's a franchise that they could be like the Red Sox. You know, they're destined never to win anything anymore,
ooh.
And that hurts me because I'm a Red Sox fan. But the Bengals,
sorry.
The Bengals are just not a very well run franchise from top. And until that changes, if it ever changes, they can do all the maneuverings and the player additions and the drafting they want to do, but they're still not going to be good enough. Now they're going to be a pretty good team this year. They really will be. I think this is a better team than they've had in past years, but there's just something missing there, and it's leadership from the very top of the organization, and that's huge in any sports team, but especially in the NFL.
The league has a new team this season, the Houston Texans. I'm sure they won't be favored to win more than a couple of games tops. Maybe they can do as well or slightly better than the Bengals, but what do the Texans have to do to make Houstonians happy?
I think that they're going to win. I think they're going to win five games, and that should make everybody in Houston just glad that they did that, and they don't have to, instead of having to worry about Enron. The Texans have done it the right way. They've started off with a foundation of younger players. They didn't spend a lot of money in the expansion draft on 30 plus guys. guys that only play 1 or 2 years. They brought in a lot of guys that should be around for a long time. And they've trying to sell everybody in Houston on the fact it's going to be a slow process. You know, they're not going to be a playoff team this year, but they're saying 5 years down the road they can be. Now, will anybody be that patient, including their owner, who spent all this money on the franchise and this great new stadium they have? Who knows? But I think they're going about it the right way. And if they can, you know, keep people healthy and get some breaks, they probably will be a very good team within 4 or 5 years.
The expansion of the league by just one team has prompted a league-wide divisional realignment. Does this disappoint fans by putting an end to some of the league's previous interdivisional rivalries, or do we have wonderful new rivalries to consider as a result?
Yeah, Bill, I think we give fans too much credit for worrying about that stuff. I think they worry more about how their team's going to be. And, you know, if they play the Sisters of the Poor every week, they think they were the greatest rivals going because they could beat them. You know? And you know, the fact, if the Redskins, all of a sudden stop playing the Cowboys, there wouldn't be any mourning in Washington. I mean, there'd be some grumbling about it. But as long as they win, they don't care who they're beating. And you know, this is going to create, new rivalries, and those rivalries will hold up until the NFL decides to realign again, and then they'll just start all over again. And that's the bottom line. All this, as long as your team wins, everybody's happy with who they're playing. If they lose, they wonder why they have such difficult schedules.
Paul Attner covers the Gridiron Gargantuans for the Sporting News and for Only a Game from time to time. Thank you, Paul.
Hey, enjoyed it, Bill. Thank you.
We're football fan loves. Every day we win. It's always first and ten.
There's more information about this week's stories on our website, onlyagame.org, where you can also read the latest sports news, browse the Only a Game store, or get in touch with us. Once a burgeoning Olympic summer sport, beach volleyball has not taken hold in the U.S., as many had predicted it would. Now the sport's top players are juggling the need to support themselves with the desire to create a new spike in the game's popularity. Nick Roman of member station KKJZ in Long Beach has this report.
The AVP, the Association of Volleyball Professionals, has been on NBC twice this summer, but not this weekend, even though the Las Vegas King and Queen of the Beach tournament features only the top players in the tour's end-of-the-season championship event. But you won't hear any complaints from Holly McPeak, the top money winner in the women's competition. That's because for the last 2 years, pro beach volleyball in the U.S. was...
Nowhere. We were nowhere. We were completely rebuilding. The current management picked us up when we had nothing. We had no sponsors, no TV, anything.
Poor management, too many tournaments, too much squabbling among players. The AVP was flattened by problems that often kill fast-growing sports after a burst of fan interest. But now beach volleyball has bounced back. They're small bounces, but Karch Karai, the only player to win Olympic gold medals in both six-player indoor volleyball and the two-player beach game, says each bounce is a little higher.
The tour is doing great these days. I think we're in the midst of a big resurgence. Seen a lot of really positive things happen.
Starting with two TV dates this summer on NBC. Ten years ago, AVP Beach Volleyball was a summer weekend staple on NBC, the Olympic Network. The beach game's young, attractive players drew a young, attractive TV demographic. But just when beach volleyball joined the Olympics as a medal sport in Atlanta in 1996, the tour began to splinter. NBC dropped its TV package, and the players abandoned the AVP for more lucrative paydays on the foreign tour.
Shot is good by EY
75. Enter, actually re-enter, sports agent Leonard Armato, one of the founders of the AVP back in 1983. As the new commissioner, Armato merged the men's and women's tours under the AVP banner, pared the schedule down to just 7 solid events, signed up so many sponsors it would make a NASCAR driver jealous, and turned each tournament into a flashy, sandy beach disco.
So cruise down to the beach, yeah. Bring your sunblock and a smile.
It didn't take Holly McPeak long to be convinced Leonard Armato's ideas would save the tour. She's married to him. But talk to any pro beach volleyball player in the U.S. and you'll hear the same thing. We have to work together now or we lose the tour. Players will sign autographs and do interviews until the tide rolls in. McPeak says that kind of single-mindedness in a sport of laid-back, hang-loose individuals is a big deal.
Huge. It's very different, and it's good that you notice that because that is the big difference. And it started 2 years ago when all of us decided to unify and go for it. Go forward together. Everybody on the same page trying to make the sport work.
It does work in Manhattan Beach, which is to beach volleyball what Cooperstown is to baseball. For more than 50 years, Manhattan Beach, just a few miles west of Los Angeles, has been home to hundreds of tall, lean, and tanned volleyball players. Nearly half of the top players in the AVP live here or a short drive from here. But here's something else. Three-quarters of those same players are 30 years old or older. Bad sign for a struggling tour with an uncertain future. But Karch Karai, the oldest pro beach player at 41, says he sees other signs.
We're seeing record numbers of men playing on this tour this year. We have typically 80 or 90 teams entered in every event, way more than on the women's side. You wouldn't expect that because there are so many more women's players in high school and in college. But the men, we often have 60 or more teams in the qualifier tournament, and then another 24 to 32 in the main draw. So we're having almost 100 teams every weekend.
On the women's side, the over 30 crowd dominates the field. Holly McPeak's partner, 32-year-old Elaine Youngs, worried about that during a break in the Manhattan Beach Open last month. She spent that break with ice on her knee. Youngs says there's a lot of talent in college playing the more regimented indoor game.
We need to get those girls talented athletes and to start building because we have a lack of depth right now at the bottom. It's, you know, it's, and there's some of us that are getting older and we're going to need that turnover.
There are good reasons for those college players to join the AVP Tour. It's an impulsive game that rewards all-around skills and clever creative play, something drill sergeant indoor volleyball coaches hate. They also don't like the fact that there are no coaches in beach volleyball. But here's the biggest plus. You're playing at the beach every weekend. Here's the biggest minus. Right now, the money isn't all that good. Holly McPeak and her partner, Elaine Youngs, have won four of the six AVP events this season. They've split $96,000. Annette Davis and Jenny Johnson Jordan, the number two money winners, have taken in $65,000. And since all a player wears is a swimsuit, sunglasses, sunscreen, and a smile, product sponsorships are slim. Holly McPeak says most of the players can't make a living on AVP earnings, even if they play on the foreign tour.
They basically have to have a job because internationally, really, you only have the top five U.S. teams. And even then, it's difficult for all those teams to make a good living and be traveling. It's expensive.
And exhausting. McPeak and Elaine Youngs have played every weekend this summer, sometimes in an AVP event, sometimes in an international event in Europe, Japan, or Brazil.
We have to take advantage of our opportunities to make money. If there's a tournament in China and we don't have one here, we're going. Not that we want to go, but we're going.
This weekend ends the season for the AVP. The goal next summer is to stretch out the seven-tournament schedule to maybe a dozen events. And maybe then, Holly McPeak can keep her feet firmly planted in the warm California sand. For Only a Game, I'm Nick Roman in Manhattan Beach.
La, 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 la. The AVP. It's a sexy sport on a little court. The AVP. Bring your portraits and your shades and some sunblock for the waves. Bring the whole family. Help us make this tour grow into a big time show. The AVP. La, 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 la.
You're listening to Only a Game. The Oakland A's lost a ball game in Minnesota last night. That wouldn't be remarkable, except that Oakland had won the previous 20 games, an American League record winning streak. The Major League record of 26 straight wins was set by the New York Giants in 1916. What is remarkable is that the A's, now leading the American League's Western Division and a virtual lock to make the playoffs as the wild card team, even if they slump over the next few weeks, made the playoffs in precisely the same way last season. In the spring, they lost 18 of 26 games, then suddenly became the hottest team in either league. Obviously, no team anywhere has been hotter over the past month. Also remarkable is how confident Oakland manager Art Howe was that his team would recover. Back in May, while the A's were falling further behind the Mariners and the Angels each night, he seemed sure that Oakland's time would come again.
Problem is, like, Justice has been hurt. We started the season with Jermaine Dye on the DL. First game of the year, Randy Velarde gets a broken hand. So, you know, we've had injuries along the way. Our number one starter's had one start where he's been healthy. We're still a long way from being healthy. If we can keep hanging around the 500 mark and get everybody healthy, then I think you're going to see a different club.
As it turned out, truer words couldn't have been spoken. Nobody remembers how badly you began the season when you put together a winning streak during which you out-hit the opposition by 80 points, outscore it by over 70 runs, hit twice as many home runs as the other guys, and post an ERA of 2.5 to your opponent's 6.95, especially when that streak runs through August and into September. Nowadays, Oakland shortstop Miguel Tejada is being touted as the league's most valuable player. A's pitcher Barry Zito has staked a creditable claim on the Cy Young Award, and Art Howe must be considered a possible manager of the year. It's easy for any observer of baseball, even me, to draw those conclusions now. It was impossible for one observer of baseball, me again, to draw them back in May, when having visited the A's and witnessed Art Howe's quiet confidence, I wrote him off as a dreamer and picked the A's for third in their division, unless it turned out that Alex Rodriguez could carry the Rangers, in which case the A's would be fourth. One of the A's slogans has been, "There are no A's in quit, and there are no A's in surrender." I cleverly turned that around and noted that there were no W's in Oakland either. Clever, right? No W's in Oakland. Yeah, clever, but wrong. Nice work, Art Howe. I should have listened. I'll look forward to seeing your guys in the playoffs. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced, and from the other NPR member stations airing this program. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish, working to solve critical legal issues on local, national, and international levels. Information at nutter.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Goldsmiths 3 of Concord, creative contemporary jewelers, handcrafting rings and other fine jewelry for engagements, weddings, anniversaries, and all days made special. For the complete picture, goldsmiths3.com. By Feynman Remodeling of Arlington, striving to create satisfied clients through innovations in architectural design, craft, and management. On the web at friremodel.com. And by 170 Systems, providing solutions in content management, document management, and business process enhancement for the Oracle Database and the Oracle eBusiness Suite on the web at 170systems.com. Good morning. I'm Dolores Handy. In sports headlines, the Red Sox snapped a three-game losing streak and beat Toronto 7-2 last night at Fenway. They play again this evening. The former shortstop Rick Burleson will be inducted into the Red Sox Hall of Fame. The three-time All-Star who turned more double plays than any Red Sox shortstop in history. Coming up on WBUR this morning at 10, Unfriendly Skies, Inside Out, a look at America's airline security since September 11th. Then at noon, it's Pax Americana, Inside Out, looking at America as a global empire. At 1 o'clock, it's Living with Terror, The World Speaks, discussing the causes of terrorism and the repercussions of the war against terrorism. Sunny and very warm today, highs in the 80s.
Hi, this is Alex Chadwick inviting you to join me this winter as we ring in the new year in the romantic City of Islands as part of the next Citizens of the World Tour to Venice. Proceeds from the trip help pay for the news.
Come sample the cuisine of Italy and learn more about this unique opportunity at a free reception on Thursday night, September 12th. Reserve your space by calling 800-909-9287.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, a conversation with Howard Bryant, the author of Shutout, a story of race and baseball in Boston. But first, joining me by phone from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, for this week's discussion of the sports news is our analyst, Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
What's up in Baton Rouge?
Oh, Kedrick Brown, a young player for the Celtics with an enormous amount of potential. And, of course, there's football, football, football everywhere because it's Louisiana.
Yeah, but since you've begun by talking about basketball, let's start there. The U.S. men's basketball team is out of the World Basketball Championships by virtue of their 81-78 loss at the hands of Yugoslavia on Thursday night. There will be no medal for the U.S. What went wrong for what is, or perhaps was, the world's basketball superpower?
Well, the first thing that went wrong is that nobody wanted to be there, and in that I include the 12 members of the United States basketball team and virtually the entire population of the city of Indianapolis. It's a strange bubble-like event that's important to the rest of the world, far out of proportion to how important it is for us. Now, that may change now that the United States has fallen on its collective duff here over the last few days. But the other thing that happened is the rest of the world is catching up with how they play basketball. And the best way to notice that is to realize that New Zealand has a chance to win a medal and the United States doesn't.
Do you agree with the Associated Press writer who wrote of Wednesday night's loss to Argentina in Indianapolis, "The basketball universe has changed forever"?
Well, the international basketball universe has changed forever. We are still talking about national teams that play together for 5 years at a stretch playing against disinterested National Basketball Association all-star teams, and not even the best all-star teams at that. If you take the Argentina team or the Yugoslavian team that beat the United States on Thursday night and put them in the NBA's Eastern Conference, they wouldn't win 18 games. But that's not the point anymore. The point is, on the national stage, the rest of the countries are now able to see that, at least in the sense of these competitions, they can compete.
Argentina will face Germany, and Yugoslavia goes up against the mighty New Zealand team in today's semifinals. Which giant killer prevails?
Well, I'm standing in my hotel room doing my haka dance right now. Argentina's played better than any team in the tournament, so they're clearly the best basketball team. But I want the New Zealanders to make the finals so we can all do the haka dance together.
The college basketball world lost one of its most remarkable coaches this week. Charlie Abe Lemons died on Monday. He was 79 years old. I know the former University of Texas coach was one of your favorites.
Yeah, I don't make many categorical statements about people I've met in this business, but I do make two. Archie Manning is the nicest person I've ever met, and Abe Lemons is the funniest person I've ever met. I spent 4 days with him when I was working for a defunct national sports newspaper. And I started laughing when I walked off the plane, and I didn't stop till I got up in the jetway. My favorite anecdote from him is the story he told about the first time he went out with his wonderful wife, Betty Jo. He said, I'm approximating the accent, "I went over and I went to Sunday services with her, and she's one of them Church of Christ people, you know. They didn't have no music or anything, so I'm back to the house, and her father said, 'What'd you think of the service?' And I said, 'Well, I thought it was pretty good, except I think y'all could use a piano.' And the old man said, sorry, it doesn't say anything in the Bible about pianos." And Abe says, and I told him, "Well, it doesn't say anything in the Bible about chairs, but you had plenty of them." He just had a wonderful knack for the difference, as Mark Twain points out, between telling a joke and telling a funny story.
The Masters Golf Tournament is still, of course, many months away, Charlie, but Martha Burke, the chairwoman of the National Council of Women's Organizations, has asked golfers to, quote, take a moral stand against the Augusta National Club for not admitting women as members. Good idea?
Oh, yeah. I mean, she might as well also have me take a moral stand to be 7'2". I mean, the best that they've gotten so far is John Daly saying that he thinks women should be advised to clubs, but he's going to go play Augusta anyway. Why are you out of your mind? It's a controversy that's become quite interesting because we are now being given object lessons in various places about the differences in discrimination between discrimination by race and discrimination by gender. Well, one of the differences is that discrimination by gender was one of the discriminations that they allowed within even the civil rights movement.
Charlie, on Thursday, the baseball owners approved the new labor agreement with a 29-1 vote, the lone dissenters being the New York Yankees, who are reportedly considering a lawsuit against Major League Baseball. Maybe there was some truth to the rumor that George Steinbrenner was on the union side all along.
Well, there was some talk that he was the best thing that ever happened to them. I'm not sure that this advanced stage in life, George Steinbrenner really wants to go it quite this much alone. I'm not exactly sure what would happen if he were to somehow get an injunction against the implementation of this agreement. I guess they would have to go back to using the old system, which is the one that, you know, if you listen to management, was bankrupting 6, 8, 12, 15, 18, 19, 23 teams. So, I mean, there's obviously some placating to be done in New York. You know, it's important to remember that they've also got the lawsuit involving the partners of the New York Mets. They've also got the lawsuit, that awful lawsuit involving the minority partners of the Montreal Expos. I mean, anybody who thought that George Steinbrenner was going to, you know, be on the same page and singing Kumbaya while they give away all his money was fooling themselves.
My favorite baseball highlight of the week occurred on Monday in Phoenix, where the Dodgers beat the Arizona Diamondbacks 19-1. Mark Grace, the Arizona first baseman, pitched the ninth inning of that game, and Dodger Dave Ross hit his first major league home run. Afterward, Grace said, quote, "I didn't have a scouting report on him. Obviously, he can hit a 65-mile-an-hour fastball."
Yeah, there will be some huffing and blowing from baseball traditionalists, but I thought it was a neat thing, too. At least Grace didn't blow out his arm the way Jose Canseco did a few years ago.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Globe and, of course, helps us out here at Only a Game each week. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Shutout, subtitled A Story of Race and Baseball in Boston by Howard Bryant, is an ambitious book. In it, Bryant recounts not only the stories of Jackie Robinson's ill-fated tryout with the Red Sox in 1945 and the team's failure to sign Willie Mays when it could have done so, but it also explores the connection between the last major league team to sign a black player and Boston itself, a city at times noted for its tolerance and at other times notorious for its segregation. Howard Bryant joins me now in the studio. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
Howard, let's begin with the story that for many folks best illustrates the racist past of the Red Sox. 57 years ago, the Sox brought Jackie Robinson to Fenway Park for a tryout. It turned out to be a cruel joke. I gather that even after considerable research, you weren't able to determine for certain who, if anybody, actually shouted the infamous racial slur while Robinson was on the field.
No, to this day, I don't think anyone knows that. There's been all kinds of analysis, and there's been plenty of talk about whether it was Tom Yawkey or Joe Cronin or a bat boy who was hanging out on the field or some kid in the stands. Nobody knows. I think that doesn't matter so much as the incident has just become emblematic or symbolic of what the Red Sox have been fighting for the past half century.
Let's jump forward in history. Several times in the book, you refer to a conversation that Jim Rice had with Ellis Burks. Each man had the distinction of being the only black player on the Red Sox for a period of time. In 1987, Rice told Burks, quote, "Get your 6 years in and then get out of Boston," meaning put in your 6 years in the league so that you could have some control over where you were traded to and then get out. What factors led Jim Rice to give Ellis Burks that advice?
Well, I think that we have to think about what Jim Rice encountered when he came into Boston. 22 years old in 1975. He's from the South. And coming into a city here that was on the cusp of busing, he was thrown into a situation that he was not very well equipped for. He was thrown into a situation where he was now supposed to be the official spokesman on race relations.
What do black folks think? Go to the one black guy available to you if you're a sports writer.
Exactly. And Rice's position on this created a real tension between himself and the Boston media. And it was never a cordial relationship in the first place, but Rice's position was, look, Boston has had racial problems before I got here. Why do I have to be the person who comments on all of this? Why do I have to be the person who sticks his neck out for this? This problem is bigger than me, and I'm not going to jeopardize what I have. And if that makes me a bad guy, then so be it. But I'm not going to put myself in any kind of compromising position with my employers.
By the time Jim Rice gave that advice to Ellis Burks, longtime Red Sox owner Tom Yawkey was dead, but to what extent was the legacy still present as far as race is concerned?
Well, I think that the problem with the Red Sox and the hardest thing to deal with is that they've never really wanted to confront this as a structural problem within their organization. Everybody knew what the team's reputation was. Everybody knew that Pinky Higgins was a devout racist and said so.
An unapologetic racist, absolutely.
And was very proud of it, absolutely. Everyone knew that Tom Yawkey had a reputation for employing people whose views were not very open toward integration in the game. But there was never an admission, either publicly or simply by action, by Yawkey that allowed people to say, oh, well, okay, things are changing. They were this at one point, and now things are moving forward. Instead, you always had one episode after another after another. And it spanned so many decades that you couldn't simply put the past in its context. The past became the future.
Much of Shutout is concerned with the history of the city of Boston. Did you know when you began the book that the racial climate of the city would be so completely entwined with the racial history of the ball club?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, and that was the goal. The Red Sox and Boston, they're only one of a few teams. I think maybe the Celtics might be the only other team, maybe the Dallas Cowboys or the Los Angeles Dodgers, where the actual sports team represents the city in a lot of different ways, where they provide a mirror for each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you can make that argument about the San Francisco Giants or the Chicago Bulls. They're just sports teams that play in certain cities. But the Red Sox are representative of Boston. They are representative of New England in many, many ways. And what I wanted to do was I wanted to try and run both of these stories along parallel tracks, because post-1967, the Red Sox are as much an institution in this area as the Boston Globe or Harvard or Boston College.
Absolutely. Now, you grew up in Boston yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So as a kid living in Dorchester, you were a baseball fan.
Sure.
Were you a Red Sox fan?
Absolutely. I was, in 1975, I was 7 years old, and everyone in Dorchester, we were all rooted for the Red Sox. We were all fans. Everybody wanted to be Yaz or Bill Lee or Louis Tiant or somebody. There was only one problem, though. None of us had ever talked about going to the games. None of us had ever been to Fenway. None of us. There was never in Dorchester that kind of knothole gang nostalgia of going down to Fenway. And what struck me was that the Red Sox didn't become present. They didn't become part of the family until we moved to Plymouth. We moved 50 miles outside of the city, outside of the black community, before the Red Sox became present.
Kids in Plymouth were talking about going to Fenway
they
Park,
went to
but
games.
Not kids
yes.
on Blue Hill Avenue.
Exactly.
In Dorchester. Right.
And race is the reason for that.
Right.
And that told me something about where I was from and a lot about the story that I wanted to write.
Among the few Boston baseball men who emerge as responsible, intelligent, and fair in your account is Dick O'Connell, who mm-hmm. built a couple of teams that were not only integrated but very successful. You speak of the 75 team, for example. Who else came to your attention as a respectable and admirable person?
Well, it's surprising as it seemed today. Dan Duquette, between Dick O'Connell and 2002, Dan Duquette was the guy who changed the complexion of the Red Sox. When you look at that ball club that he took over in 1994 and you look at it today, there's no way that you can look at this team and say that the Red Sox have any type of agenda in terms of the complexion of the ball players that they select.
No, he ran Mo Vaughn out of town, but he ran Roger Clemens out of town too.
Well, he was an equal opportunity bad guy, you should say. You know, I have to say, Bill, that I really think that between Mo Vaughn and Dan Duquette, these are the two seminal figures in Red Sox history on this issue. And it's so typical Red Sox that these two guys couldn't get along, that they couldn't tie their names to history together in a positive way, because on the one hand, outside of Dick O'Connell, Dan Duquette was the first Red Sox executive that really made a conscious effort to change the Red Sox culture in terms of acquiring Latin black ball players, so you couldn't make this levy this charge against them.
And Latin and black ball players who didn't have to be superstars. They could
exactly.
be the guy in
could be 25th
18,
guy.
19, and 20 on
mm-hmm.
the bench, right.
Exactly. And Mo Vaughn was the first black player to come to Boston and not only thrive in Boston, but be embraced by the Boston community, but be embraced by the fans.
Has anybody connected with the Red Sox responded to what you've done in this book?
Right now, no, because the book's brand new. I've had some conversations with some members of the organization, of the new regime, who were very, very interested, shall we say, in the history, and very interested in what they've purchased. One of the themes that came through working on this book from numerous people was that the racial legacy of the Red Sox will not change until the Yawkey regime fades into history once it's finally over. Well, it's over now, and this new ownership has a chance to make history. I think I had said to John Henry when I met him, you're going to make history no matter what you do, and it's your choice where it goes.
You write early in Shutout that, quote, without the mythology, of course, there is no game, and baseball is then just another pointless exercise where people run around for fun. It's a shame, isn't it, that so much of the mythology of this particular team has been so poisonous?
Yeah, it is. And I think that what I enjoyed most about finishing this project is the knowledge that 10 years ago, I don't think you could have written it. 10 years ago, you could have tried to write it, but I don't think there was enough hope. I don't think that enough good things had happened to give you any feeling that things were going to change. But I think now, when you look at the team and you look at what they've done and you look at the fact that they do have Pedro Martinez out front, and it was a failed experiment, but they did go out and trade for Carl Everett, and they have done things that would make you say, hey, you know, this is a different group now, and that maybe finally we can start to think about race in a different light. I mean, it's never going to go away because it exists in every part of our society, but at least you're not going to tag the Red Sox with that scarlet letter that's been on their brow for forever.
Howard Bryant is the author of Shutout, a story of race and baseball in Boston, published by Routledge. Howard, thank you for speaking with me.
Phil, my pleasure.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is Tad Curry. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear our program again, sign up for our newsletter, or learn more about Howard Bryant's Shutout, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word this week comes from Oakland Athletics manager Art Howe, who last May shrugged off his team's miserable start.
So what? You know, Seattle's due to have a losing streak, too.
Man, this guy can't miss. I wish I'd asked him about the stock market 4 months ago. I'll have to get back to him right before the Kentucky Derby. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, educating discerning patients and dentists since 1985 about their options for the replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is WB
Radio.
This is WB.